we have ceded the socialization of our young people to private companies, to social media companies. That's what we have done. These kids are being socialized. They are being made into the humans they are via these companies, which are almost entirely private. They're not public. As a culture, we have not come up with meaningful ways to counter that. We have mostly thrown up our hands and we have let it happen.
How do you see America at this point? We're talking in October of 2025. I'd love to just start the conversation with getting your perspective on
I think this isn't a hot take, but I see America as broadly and deeply polarized, deeply cynical about our institutions, deeply pessimistic. I think not just polarized, but I think engaged in deep and truly upsetting mutual recrimination. Not everybody, but, you know, you mentioned Charlie Kirk, Dan. I don't know if you had a chance to watch the ceremony in Glendale, Arizona, but I thought there you got actually a very good illustration of where we are. Erica Kirk, the widow of the murdered Charlie Kirk, gave a very gracious statement. And then the president of the United States got up and said, so I really like Charlie Kirk and Erica Kirk, but I disagree with them on one thing. They said that they want to love their opponents, and I hate my opponents. And so I think that's kind of the dividing line in America. I think there are some of us that want to find ways to communicate across our divides, but I think we're in the minority. And I think Trump spoke not just for the people who voted for him, but for a significant chunk of people on my side of the political aisle who have no interest in speaking to somebody who's MAGA or somebody who's their opponent. So that's where we live. And Trump got that right in a very sad way.
How do you make sense of how we have gotten to this point? Obviously, there's always been division in the country, and maybe it makes sense to have you sort of frame this in your lifetime of perspective of where you think we are in divisiveness in general, but I'd love to put that to you.
Well, look, you know, the political scientists have been trying to answer this question for 20 years, and I'm not a political scientist, but I am a historian, and here's one thing I'll say. When the John Birch Society was campaigning against fluoridation in the 1950s, they had to go door to door with leaflets or take out little square advertisements in local newspapers. The anti-fluoridation people now don't have to do that. They can go right on the net and they can get millions of clicks. And that's not the only reason that we've come to this moment, but it's absolutely, I think, any story you tell would have to begin with that. And fluoridation is a great example, because we've always had anti-fluoridation people, always, just like we've had anti-vax people. And the Birch Society thought fluoridation was a communist plot. I haven't heard Bobby Kennedy say that, but they're both opposed to fluoridation. And the larger point is that in the era of Bobby Kennedy, because of these new communication tools, they were able to enlist a lot more adherence and a lot more power, and they were able to get fluoridation removed from big swaths of the United States. And absent the internet, I just don't see how that happens. The Birch Society would have loved it, but they didn't have access to it.
How about your take on the state of divisiveness? You know, when I have conversations about the moment we live in with friends, I will often refer to the 60s as being a more tumultuous time, and that there were more assassinations, there was more upheaval socially. I don't know if you concur with that, but how do you frame this era, whether this is, you know, the last 5 or 10 years with the rise of social media and the ubiquity of the internet? How do you think about
Here's why it's worse. It's worse because of the decline of formal religion. Formal religion says things like love thy enemy as thyself. And that may not be easy to do, but at least it says that. And, you know, figures like King and Niebuhr said that as well. Formal religion is in a tailspin in this country. I think it's the most important development we talk the least about. So the way sociologists generally measure this kind of stuff is, you know, reported weekly worship attendance, reported belief in God. Both those things are 20% down in 20 years. It is a straight vector down. We're not Western Europe yet, but we're trending in that direction. Now, why does this make polarization worse? Here's why. Because blue and red have substituted for formal religion. They've become quasi-religions, but without the tempering love thy neighbor effect that formal religion has. Blue and red don't say love thy neighbor, Dan. They don't say that. They say thy neighbor is a plague on the land and a dagger at the heart of the republic. Don't love it. Stamp it out. And I often play for my students Martin Luther King's famous speech about Bull Connor, where he says, I don't like Mr. Connor, but I must love Mr. Connor. And they're just blown away, because it's so different from their political and their religious reality. I mean, I once asked a group of undergrads what Martin Luther King's profession was, and it was super interesting. A lot of people said lawyer. My favorite answer, policy expert. I've always loved that one. I have a dream that one day, thanks to the earned income tax credit, the poverty rate will decline 2%. Of course, he was a minister, and this is the point, right? I think the decline of formal religion makes it harder for us to rally around and evoke figures like King, whose religion did call for the opposite of what Donald Trump said. Right? The direct opposite, perpendicular, right? King said, I have to love Mr. Connor, and Trump said, I hate my enemies. That's the difference.
I would imagine when you are talking to your students, you must have a space to try to discuss ways to get the hell out of this. What are you discussing? What are you coming up
Well,
with
I
in the
mean,
classroom?
I'll tell you what I suggest to them. I suggest to them to very consciously every day consume media that is not curated for them. So, we may have talked about this before, Dan, but every night I watch Fox News for at least part of the evening. And the reason I do that is I know if I watch MSNBC or CNN, they'll just confirm my worldview. And that, to use a loaded metaphor, will not get me closer to God. I really won't learn anything from it. I don't learn anything really from watching CNN and MSNBC. I learn a lot from watching Fox. I learn how Americans who think differently from me see the world. And so I'm constantly pleading with my students, don't go the news feed route. And Dan, let's pause a moment to think about that metaphor. Your news feed. Time for your 2 p.m. feeding, right? Curate it to your search history and all of your biases. It's going to be good. You're going to like it. You know what? Here's what's perverse. You do like it. And the evolutionary psychologists have taught us a lot about this, right? When you see something that confirms your biases, all the pleasure centers light up, right? It's like, I hate Trump also. It feels good. But then if you're confronted with things that contrast with what you believe, your brain is like, ow, what the fuck? Ow, stop. Like, this hurts. Don't do this. The most natural thing in the world is just to love your tribe and hate the other tribe. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise, right? What King was recommending was unnatural. What Trump is recommending is natural. Trump is much more in line with everything that we've learned about our natural instincts. And that's precisely why we have to resist it, because it is so natural.
I'd love to get your thoughts on what you think the root of a lot of this stems from. If you really think it's the incentive, financial incentives of the social media companies that, to your point, are feeding you these dopamine snacks, this information junk food that just gets you on a sugar high. Where do you come down on where you think the root responsibility lies in terms of fueling and incentivizing and exacerbating the kind of division that we're talking about?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, to your earlier point, we've had divisions before. And by the way, I mean, in the 90s and the Clinton years, I think that's really the beginning of the polarization story, and the internet was in its infancy, right? At least social media was, right? So you can't really blame it all on that. I think that I already mentioned the decline of religion, and that's when it began, in the 90s. I think that's really important. And then, although this re-asked the question, I think that the rise of higher education as a mass institution has obviously contributed to this. The higher education is itself a polarizing force. The best predictor of how you voted in 2024 was whether you have a college degree. It's a better predictor than your race, your class, income level, everything. There's a book by a guy at Michigan State called Divided by Degrees that goes, into this straight into the weeds. And it's really good and really important, especially for those of us who imagine education as a kind of unifying force. It isn't. In fact, the more formal education you have, the less likely it is that you're going to have a conversation with somebody that doesn't share your opinion. In other words, education does precisely the opposite of what most of us say we want it to do.
And what have you learned from all of those hours of watching Fox News? You know,
Well,
the change
I
in
learned that
yourself.
my wife really doesn't like it. Fortunately, we have a big enough house that she can just go in another room because it just gets her too upset. And just to be honest, sometimes it gets me upset too because there are things on there that, I find bigoted. There are things on there that I'm sure are wrong, just factually wrong. But I'll say a couple things. I've learned that, sometimes what you hear on Fox News is stuff that you heard a lot from like radical lefties you went to grad school with. I'll give you a good example. Listen to Tucker Carlson about the Ukraine. And here's what he'll say. He'll say things like, this is all about the efforts of like the military industrial complex to create a market for its products. It's about America trying to stick its mouth and its foot in places where it shouldn't be and exert hegemony in a part of the world where it shouldn't. More or less, just like what my lefty friends in grad school said about American foreign policy in about, circa 1988. Now I'm not saying that Carlson is right or even that we were right back then, but it's humbling, right? Because, you see that, despite all of the just all of the culture war garbage, what you see is actually, and in a very interesting way, more overlap between Americans when you start actually focus, in weird and unpredictable ways. I'm not saying it's all lovey-dovey and we all agree with each other because we wouldn't be having this conversation if that were true. What I'm saying is you start to see the kind of intricate patterns of the rug and the strange ways that different views overlap, and it's unpredictable. I mean, look, when I was in college, who wanted more immigrants coming to the country? Ronald Reagan. Who wanted fewer? Bernie Sanders.
The book we talked about 4 years ago was specifically about free speech, and I'm curious what you knew about Charlie Kirk. I wanted to spend part of this conversation
Yeah.
about his life. How well did you know him before the world
I never
all
met
knew his
him,
face?
but I did read about him. I thought he was a fascinating figure. I still do. I think extremely smart. Somebody who was, by the way, a voracious reader. Somebody who was an auto diktat. One of the ironies of all of his organizing activities at college is he actually did not go to college except briefly to a community college. And here's where, for me, the most tragic part comes in. He was also, at least rhetorically, a great advocate for free speech and dialogue. I say rhetorically because, like lots of us, he did not always believe and act in accord with his beliefs. Take the professor watch list, for example, where he reads about a professor that says or writes something he doesn't like, and pushes it on the net, and that person gets doxxed by like a million angry MAGA people, right? That doesn't seem to me very consistent with, a belief in kind of dialogue and open exchange. But to the guy's credit, he showed up, 150 campuses a year, and he engaged people in dialogue. Now, I after he was murdered, I watched a lot of his video, and I think that, in part because he was so smart and read so much, it was very easy for him to dunk on some of these callow 20-year-olds. That's what a lot of the videos were about. They were about owning the libs, for sure. And his signature rap was "Prove me wrong." But I watched hours and hours of Charlie's videos, and I never saw him proven wrong, right? But even so, I think it's a good thing for more people like Charlie Kirk to show up on campuses like mine. I wish we had a more active Turning Point organization. Maybe we will in the wake of his murder. And the reason for that, Dan, and the reason that I've always been vociferous about free speech is that I'm an educator. That's the reason. And I think the way we learn is by being exposed to things that are not us. That's why I watch Fox News, and that's why I think it'd be good if Penn had a, you know, had a vociferous Turning Point USA chapter.
Yeah.
People with
How do you view his murder in, you're a historian, as you mentioned, in the context of American history? Where does this rank in your mind among the
Very hard
well-known
to
things?
place. It's very hard to place. And, you know, there's been so much ink spilled about, you know, what were the quote politics of his assassin? It's going to be a very long time before we know the answer to that. Obviously, Jimmy Kimmel was pushed off the air for making a statement about that, although he did return. I think it's way too early to tell. But given what we've read, it's at least possible, Dan, that that's the wrong question. What are the politics of this shooter? Because it may well be that the shooter lives in this kind of internet underworld that doesn't really track with what you think of as Democratic or Republican. You know, ditto for, you know, Luigi Mangione. You know, I think that that's what makes it different from, you know, earlier eras of assassinations. And now we get back to, you know, the digital world. You know, I mean, it's very clear that the assassin of Kirk and also this fellow who killed the people at ICE, that they spent the majority of their waking hours in this kind of internet netherworld that was full of its own language and memes, its own symbolic systems. And I don't know that those systems actually track with what you and I call party politics.
I think that's an excellent point. I don't know if you have come across in your own work, on university campuses with students that you fear are at risk, or you're seeing symptoms of someone falling down into this netherworld that you just mentioned. But I would love to get your thoughts on, I guess this may be specific for men, it not necessarily unique to young boys, but it seems like there is a pattern here.
Yes.
Of how you think about young men specifically, and what advice you would give their parents, or even just directly to them, about how to avoid these incredible seductions that they are faced with time and again, that can lead them down these
Yeah.
rabbit holes into,
Well, look,
murderous
there's, I
activity.
mean, Dan, there's a lot in your question, but, you know, there, I don't think anyone, at least anyone serious, disputes the fact that we have a real problem with young men in this country.
Yeah.
And there's so much data. Look at schools, look at K-12 schools, right? The girls are radically outpacing the boys in every way we can measure, which makes for, by the way, all sorts of ironies and perversities in
Completely.
college admissions, because now we have affirmative action for men, mostly white men, who just won't admit it. But if we did gender-blind classes, we bring in classes that were three-quarters women,
Yeah.
you know? Which, by the way, in my view, wouldn't be a bad thing, but in the view of the institutions would be, because then the high-achieving women would stop applying because it would be seen as a women's school, you know, and so on. But without going too far into the weeds, I think all of that is a symptom of a real problem. And the problem is that we are doing a poor job of educating and socializing boys. Again, we can debate the roots of this, we can debate the remedies of this, but it seems to me the phenomenon is unmistakable, and it does us no good to pretend otherwise. You know, our institutions, our families, our schools, our universities have done a poor job reaching out to boys, a poor job helping them find meaning. And that's really what this is about. And, you know, obviously, girls spend a lot of time on screens too, but you know, they're probably not on the same sites that the for the most part that Charlie Kirk shooter was on. And you know, I think that there's a kind of also a broader conversation in all of this, you know, about the way that we have ceded the socialization of our young people to private companies, to social media companies. That's what we have done. These kids are being socialized. They are being made into the humans they are via these companies, which are almost entirely private. They're not public. We have, as a culture, we have not come up with meaningful ways to counter that. We have mostly thrown up our hands and we have let it happen.
You've mentioned religion a couple of times, and I wonder what you think about this. If the attractiveness towards these extreme ideologies, these nether worlds online that bring, men into their orbit and really drive their behavior, if you view that as akin to a cult-like seduction, as a religious motive that is being satiated by digital hallucinations. How do you think about
Well,
that?
look, I mean, like so much of this, I hate to sound like a professor, but it does depend on how one is defining and imagining religion. But let me just say this. Historically, since I mentioned meaning before, right, religion was the primary source of meaning. It was the primary source of answers to big existential questions like, why are we here? What is our purpose here? What happens to us after we're gone? And Dan, you take that away, you're going to have a vacuum. And that's what we have.
Is your suggestion typically a return to a moderate, modern form of religion? What I know it probably depends on the student, but is that as a rule of thumb, something that you typically encourage?
No. I don't encourage my students to worship because I don't. That said, being Jewish is a huge part of my identity. I just rarely go to synagogue. But the way I've conducted my life, the choices I've made, the things I'm interested in are deeply inflected by my identity as a Jew, without a doubt. But that's just me, right? I'm not in the, by the way, Judaism is not an evangelical religion, so I'm certainly not to recruit more Jews, and I'd be the wrong guy to do that anyway. I don't think it's my place to tell people that they should, quote, be more religious. But let me say this, that I do have my own secular religion. It's called liberal education. That's my secular religion. And that's the gospel that I try to spread, that we are at our most human, our most able, our most empathetic when we're informing ourselves about the world. And when we're probing these questions, the same questions that religion has probed, and examining all the different answers that people have given. That's what liberal education is supposed to do. And I think liberal education does or can provide deep meaning to people. Everyone has their own sort of aphorism about this, but my favorite is courtesy of Judith Shapiro, who used to be the president of both Barnard and Bryn Mawr. And somebody said, what should liberal education do for you? And she said, well, the first thing it should do is to make your head an interesting place to hang out for the rest of your life. And even though it sounds pedestrian, I put a lot of, to use a loaded term, meaning in that. I think liberal education can enchant the world for us. And by enchant, I mean just like make it incredibly interesting and blow your mind about all the amazing ways that human beings have acted and thought. That's how I've tried to spend my life, is evangelizing for that.
When we met in your home in Philly, there was a line you shared during that conversation that has stuck with me, which I think I recently rediscovered in an essay I was reading by Leonard Hand. And I will probably butcher this line, but it was something he was giving, I believe, a commencement address you were noting. And he said
No,
something.
actually, it was even better. He was swearing in new immigrants.
That's right. That's right. It
Yeah,
was an
in
an
Central
immigration
Park
center.
of all places. Yeah.
The line, I believe, and you correct me where I'm wrong, is the spirit of liberty is that which is not so certain it is correct. Please fill in the gaps with that line. But I'd love to, in the spirit of that sentiment, which is a humble statement, because people, to your point, I think by nature want to believe they are correct, that they know everything, that their tribe is the correct tribe. In the spirit of that outlook, I'm wondering how you think about how that can be injected into the minds of a modern person to lower the temperature a little bit, to
Yeah.
reflect on their own certainties more often. I'd love to give that to
Well,
you.
look, I'm glad you brought up Learned Hand because that's probably the speech I quote the most. This is 1944. It's wartime. He's
That's right.
swearing to new immigrants at Central Park. And like the Gettysburg Address, what's beautiful about the Spirit of Liberty is it's like 2 minutes long,
Yeah.
and I often share it with my students for that reason. Like, you don't have to go on and on. Like, you can say something really meaningful in a short space, like these guys did. They really did. And, interestingly, the part you left out is for me the most relevant part. And that's the part where he says, look, if we can't hold on to that spirit, no law and no constitution is going to save us. This is an educational and a spiritual problem. It's not a legal one. And remember, Learned Hand is himself a judge and arguably the most important legal figure in American history that wasn't on the Supreme Court. So it's not like this guy doesn't know his way around the law. He does. But what he's actually pointing to is the limits of the law. And I'm speaking to you today from the University of Pennsylvania, whose motto is, and this is it's in Latin, which of course I can't say, but it translates to, laws without morals are useless. And I think Learned Hand in the Spirit of Liberty is saying a version of that. He probably has a different understanding of morals than, the people in the 18th century that, that named Penn. But I think the spirit, if you will, is the same, which is, we need, as members of a nation, to socialize people to a set of habits, habits of the mind and habits of behavior. And if we fail in that, the nation's going to fail. And we're not going to be able to pass a law or a constitutional amendment that's going to remedy that.
I heard Niall Ferguson make this analogy, another historian, of saying that it was in his view, the onslaught of the ubiquity of social media in everyone's hands all day long, and the rise of the internet in general, and the information explosion that was causing was akin, in his mind, to the advent of the printing press, and he was making the claim that what followed in Germany and Europe, as I'm no expert on this, but this is me parroting him, was a lot of bloodshed and a very violent time as people adapted to this incredible new technology that was putting ideas in their head that was leading to a change in behavior, often violently. How do you think about, I don't know if you agree with that rough analogy, but I'd love to put the time we're in some sort of historical context. I mean, to me, it seems like we don't have the immune system culturally to combat the negative effects of what's happening, like with cigarettes, took generations to, by the time I was a young kid, my parents were, and all of the adults I knew were imploring us not to smoke. I'd love to put that to you and get a historian's perspective on how you think about the modern time we're in.
Yeah, look, I think, unlike Ferguson, and I know this is going to sound wimpy and wishy-washy, but I think we're too close to this revolution to take its measure, right? Because we're in the very early innings. It's easy to forget that, I have two adult daughters at 32 and 29. I don't think they got on Facebook until they were in high school.
Yeah.
It didn't exist. I mean, like, and they're not that old. Right. So I think, we do always have to take a beat, right? And just remind ourselves just how recent all this is. I think there's this tendency to kind of naturalize it and just imagine, oh yeah, like we've always had Instagram. No, we've had Instagram for 8 years or whatever it is, right? And so everything is very new. This is still the early innings, and that is one of the things that gives me hope, frankly. I think we have to avoid this idea that this is a huge, massive break with the past. To Ferguson's point, it could be, right? But things like that can weirdly become self-fulfilling prophecies too, which makes me sort of nervous, right? I think also Americans have always been suckers for techno-futurism. We just love that shit. You know, it's like, oh, look at this
Mm-hmm.
new gizmo. Everything's going to be different. Oh, there's a radio. It's all going to be different. There's TV. You know, their computer tur their PCs. You know, everything's going to be different. It's going to be a brave new world, Dan. It's all going to be different. And you know, it was and it wasn't. There's always a Venn diagram, right? I mean, there's always change, but then there's continuity as well. I mean, this is why we study history, because we're trying to figure out where that overlap is, right? There are two things historians hate. They hate it when people say everything is going to be the same, and they hate it when people say everything is going to be different. They hate those two things because they're just the same, different sides of the same coin, and they're both wrong. It's always in between, right? Or I guess more properly, it's always both, right? Some things are continuing, other things are changing. And you know, I think that the worst error we can make is to imagine that the future has already been set. It has not been. This is up to us. I mean, think about the whole dialogue around AI, speaking of religions, because clearly for some people that is one, right? But you know, in higher ed especially, we're wrestling with this. I have still got not gotten a good answer to what I will call the Neil Postman question. I don't know if you remember Neil Postman, but he wrote this book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which turned out to be a very Christian book. It was about television, not the internet, because the internet really didn't exist. But Neil actually hired me at my job at NYU a million years ago, and I adored Neil. And I'm really glad that he's sort of come back, although he's been passed for many years. My favorite aphorism from Neil was went like this: whenever there's a new technology or a new reform of any kind, your first question shouldn't be, what's it going to do for us? You get to that later. The first question is, or should be, to which problem are we imagining this as a solution? That should always be the first question. And with AI and education, I haven't heard a good answer. Look, Dan, a lot of things that AI does in the private sector, I can answer that question really easily, right? The problem is labor costs, and AI saves them. I get it, right? If I made widgets and I had to hire 10 dudes to make the widgets and I could replace them with a bot, I would. All right, problem solved, right? The problem are labor costs, okay, and AI solves the problem. But if we're talking about the university and teaching and learning, what are we trying to solve for? Has there been inadequate teaching and learning at the university? Yes, I wrote a whole book about that. All right, I'm not questioning that. What I'm asking is how the bot can be a solution to those deficiencies. And nobody's given me an answer. The answers tend to be, well, it's here. Come on. Okay, it's here, but again, that's so lame. That just absolves of responsibility. Got to get on that train, John. Train's leaving the station. It's here. Well, yes, it is here. But I think our duty is to figure out how we can use it to promote learning rather than inhibit it. And I haven't seen yet good evidence that we even know how to do that, let alone that we're doing it.
Yeah. I mentioned before we started recording that I now live in Brooklyn, and across the river from me is NYU, which I'm sure it sounds like you know very
There's a
well and
branch of
spent time.
NYU in Brooklyn, in downtown Brooklyn, the engineering school. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yes. And
Jonathan Haidt.
I taught at NYU for 20 years. That's my home.
Well, I know Jonathan Haidt is there now and that he is campaigning for removing phones from schools. And apparently, from my understanding of this, you probably know far more than I do, there has been widespread or at least some success in both red and blue states in implementing this. What are the other, if you agree with that general movement, I'd be curious to know what else you see as, potential developments of creating the kind of future, to your point of not being a fatalist about this, that we can begin to implement to change things for the better.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I'm really glad you mentioned John, you know, who is a old friend from my NYU days. I think he's spot on about this. And I'm glad that you mentioned that this is a bipartisan effort because, you know, this could be a place where we could actually have some, you know, blue-red unity. Because it really doesn't matter what political party you're in if your kid is in the iPhone prayer position for 16 hours. To your question, what else could we do? Extend that to college. See, we don't have a K through 12 system. We have a K through 16 system. There are 20 million people in higher ed alone. All right. I don't think we're doing them any favors if we ban the gizmos from K through 12 classrooms and then they get to college and it's like, hey, take out your phone and do whatever the hell you want. Play Candyland or whatever it is you do. And so I don't have any tech in my classroom. It's absolutely verboten. If you have like a real learning issue that requires you to use a machine and you can document that, obviously that's an exception. But otherwise, no. Because there's so much evidence that it's bad for learning. I'll be honest with you. There was a time in my career I was much more libertarian about it, and my view was, look, you're adults. You can vote in elections. You can die in wars. If you want to distract yourself during class with shoe shopping and sports scores, and not to engage in any deep, deep gender stereotypes, but those are the two things that women and men most commonly served. My view was as a libertarian, well, I'm not going to like it, but that's your call. But then, Dan, I found the evidence, and it's robust, that if you're surfing the net, the kid next to you is distracted. And once I saw that, cold turkey, baby. You do have a right to distract yourself, even though I might deplore it. You have no right, none, to distract somebody else. So what I do is I give people that research the very first day of class. I just show it to them. And I say, you may wonder why you can't use any machines. Here's why. You have a right to distract yourself. You have no right to distract somebody else. We have a K through 16 system, and it's not going to work if in K through 12 you don't use the machines, and then it's open sesame in the last 4 years. So I think that's one thing we absolutely should do, and I think there's been some movement in that direction. It's harder, right? It's harder at the college level because the faculty have more power, right? And they're very jealous of it, And there have been interesting wars in different places where somebody tries to turn off the internet in their classroom, it gets turned off in another faculty's classroom. And you know how we professors can be, we're very high maintenance. So it's complicated. But I think that's one thing. I think the other thing we need to think about. Josh Rothman had a piece in the New Yorker recently called "Should College Be Harder?" And the answer is yes, college should be way harder. AI is not helping because AI is making it ever easier. And Josh interviewed me in the piece, and during the interview, he made a proposal which he only nodded to in the piece, and I wish he had given more ink to, which is, why isn't a rich school like the one I teach at tried an experiment like, we're going to take over a whole building and call it the writing building. And everything you write has to be submitted from that building. And because we're rich, it's going to have comfy chairs and lots of snacks and beautiful skylights. But it's also going to have all the AI turned off. You'll be able to Google other things, but you won't be able to access AI. Why hasn't anyone tried that? I mean, again, maybe they have, and I haven't heard about it, but I think I probably would have. I think we really need to be thinking out of the box on this stuff, and most of all, we need to be experimenting. What I just described, like, I can't pledge that that would quote work, but I do know that we need to be experimenting, and we need to be thinking about, just radical ideas that might help us see our way through this moment.
That point you made about how distraction begets distraction is fascinating. I mean, it reminds me of secondhand smoke. It's basically
Yeah.
secondhand distraction.
Exactly, right? And I think that's a really good analogy. You do have the right to give yourself lung cancer with cigarettes. You don't have the right to give somebody else lung cancer with cigarettes. Yeah.
Do you see? I know we're getting close to the end of the conversation. I'd love to
Yeah.
close with a couple things. Is it? I'm wondering from the beginning of your career to now, and you still work with students. Is it obvious to you that you are seeing more distracted more depressed, more anxious on average students
Oh,
that
of
come into your
course.
classroom? Is that clear as day to you?
It is as clear as day. And look, I have empathy, Dan. If I had lived in the media environment that they grew up in, I would be exactly like them. This is not their fault. It's our fault, actually. It's our collective fault, that we seeded a good part of their socialization to these private companies. Who hook them to a certain kind of activity. And I would be exactly like them. Like there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, I'm so glad these machines didn't exist when I was a kid, because it would have made me anxious and depressed. And I would have watched a lot of porn. And I think that that would have messed me up. And I'm really glad that, like, when I was 16, I would have. I mean, to me, the interesting question isn't why 16-year-old boys watch porn. It's like, why don't they watch it 24/7? I think I would have, and I think it would have effed me up. I think it would have really twisted my brain and my body about what sex is or should be. So I have only empathy, actually. I don't have anything against these kids, quite the contrary. I feel terribly for them and the raw deal that we gave them. And we have to step up our game in every way. We have to save them. We have not attended in the right way to their growth as human beings. And we have to step up our game.
I would love to close with talking about one of your areas of expertise, which is freedom of speech. And I mentioned to you that after Charlie died, you were one of the people that I thought of that I wanted to talk to. And I'd love to, in the wake of that assassination, close the conversation by giving you some time to talk about the state and the importance of dialogue. It's why I do what I do, is to try to have, in some small way, a forum for productive conversations that are helpful, that are moving things in a more positive direction. And I'd love to just close to give you some time to talk about a subject I know you care a lot about, which is the ability for people to speak openly and freely with one another, and maybe how that might be the tool we need to begin to try to change some of this.
Well, look, of course, it's the tool we need. But what we've learned, and the Charlie Kirk assassination is a great example of this, is that we hate each other too much to do it. That's what we've learned, right? I mean, Charlie Kirk himself said there's no such thing as hate speech. You can look it up. He said it should all be fair game. And then the Attorney General of the United States threatened to jail people for using hate speech about Charlie Kirk. That's what happened, right? I mean, it's so hypocritical, it's so inconsistent, right? That we're in the same breath, we're valorizing this guy as a champion of free speech, and then what we're doing is we're not just hating on, but we're actually trying to fire people that said things about him that we don't like. And the inconsistency is on every side. Journalists often call and ask me about the fate of free speech, and my answer is always, we're all Marxists now. Not Marxists like you think, not Karl Marx. I may have mentioned this to you in an earlier conversation. A Marx who's actually closer to my family story. I speak, of course, of Groucho Marx. And it was Groucho Marx who said, if you don't like my principles, I've got others. And that's how we're all Marxists, right? So, the likes of Elise Stefanik, who was complaining for years about cancel culture in elite higher ed spaces, they become the cancelers in chief, saying we're suffused with anti-Semitism and you've got to control that speech. But at the same time, all right, my fellow lefties, who for years and years were like saying that speech is violence and speech that targets minorities or non-whites has to be restricted. Now, somebody wants to say from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. They've gone all ACLU on us. And they're like, oh, no, you have to protect that. Now, of course, you do have to protect that. I agree with them. But these are the same people who are telling us that speech is violence. Don't they think that some people might interpret that statement about river to the sea as violent? By the way, some people do, right? That is not a reason to censor it. But you would imagine it would be a reason for people on the left who were saying speech is violent to reconsider that. But no, we can't do that. We can never say we're wrong because we want to win more than we believe in free speech. And if all you want is free speech for what you say, you don't believe in the principle. You just want your side to win. And unfortunately, that's where we are. Now, to the point of your question, of course we need new ways to talk to each other. And, I think it's got to begin at the youngest grades. If I were king, and I'm going to have to go teach in a moment, we don't have enough time to explain why that will never come to be. But, starting in late elementary school, every Wednesday in America, we'd call it the American Hour. And here's what would happen. Dan, if you lived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, like you, your school would be paired with a school in northern Alabama, the reddest part of America. And, over Zoom, you would have structured discussions every Wednesday. And it would be noon in New York and 11 in northern Alabama, or maybe the other way around. And 1 week you do abortion rights, the next week you do the Ukraine, the next week you do the border wall. And the reason you would do that is because this is a practice that people have to learn. It's not natural. No one comes out of the womb being able to do it. Wah, I'm going to listen to everything you say. Wah, not kill you. In fact, like I was saying earlier, it's the opposite. We're programmed to hate on each other. So if we want to interrupt that, we've got to start at the earliest ages. And most of all, we have to give people practice. Enough with this talk about free speech. I hate talking about free speech. I want to do it. All right. I want to practice it. It's a behavior, it's an act. And we need at the youngest ages to start teaching people how to do it, or we're toast. We're done.
Well, on that note, Jonathan, it was really great to see you, man. And I really
Yeah.
want to just say on behalf of a lot of people how much I appreciate the work you continue to do and the people you continue to teach. And thank you so much for coming back on and having this conversation.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for attending to all of these important questions. I really appreciate it.
My
Yeah.
pleasure.